I've thinking about this kind of the theme of this course over the last number of weeks before it started, and a lot of interesting thoughts come up, and it's been very helpful to me in some ways. I've kind of developed my own ways of categorizing and understanding kind of what we're doing in meditation. It's not as though it's kind of dramatically new, but just ways of kind of conceptualizing and understanding. And I want to just share with you one framing of it, of what's going on with the mind, kind of bringing together the Buddhist understandings, the Buddhist teachings, and the science. When we're meditating, and also you could say this about when we're in daily life as well, but I'll focus more on when we're meditating. I think there tend to be three kind of modes of experiencing what is going on, or more of paying attention or not paying attention, as the case may be. One we'll talk about this evening quite a bit is where the attention goes when we're not really paying attention, kind of the quality of being distracted, of being somewhere else. And when we're somewhere else, then it tends to be associated with not with well-being, but with a lot of kind of more negativity, more stressful. And I'll talk about some of the studies of this evening. This quality of being distracted, I mean, that's one mode where, you know, the scientific studies are tending to show that we spend a lot of time in this mode of kind of chattering, of talking about what's going on, but we're not really present. We're not present for our actual experience. And the way we work with this mode is to bring in meditation is to just be aware of it, and then to choose to come back to the present, choose to come back to our senses, to the body, to the breath, to awareness of the present moment. So there's nothing inherently wrong in being in this more distracted mode. It's just somewhere where the mind easily goes when we're not actually paying attention. Kind of. So in the Buddhist teachings, it's like it's not a problem at all. It's just something to be seen. We say, oh, mind's gone off. Just as we do in meditation, we notice, oh, I'm planning my, you know, the email I want to send to my boss tomorrow, you know, or... you know, I'm thinking about the shopping I'm going to do because I'm out of milk and eggs and whatever. You know, wherever the mind goes, something that happened today, etc. And so the more that we can, you know, from the Buddhist standpoint of the teachings, the more we can just see that this is what the mind does, then we can train our mind to come back and be present, not to beat ourselves up about, oh, why is my mind always wandering? If we do that, then we have two arrows, don't we? We have the mind wandering and then beating ourselves up about the mind wandering. So it's an extra dose of suffering. You could say, you know, that the first is just the pain. It's just the natural kind of thing that, you know, this human thing that we get caught. We get stuck at times. The second arrow is when we judge ourselves, beat ourselves up, etc. So that's the part that we can, if the mind's wandered, it's wandered, and we can just come back again. So we have a choice really of either just noticing it and coming back, or we can judge ourselves or add, you know, suffering and stress to that experience. And that doesn't make sense, but we do it. Or we could choose just to stay caught up in the, you know, in the whatever story we're caught up in. But that's not going to be a very happy place to be. So it actually serves us. The teachings say it serves us to come back to the present moment, because the present moment is where we can experience life, you know, fully, that we can experience joy and connection and love and all of the other, you know, wholesome qualities that that are possible. We have to be here to experience them. So this quality of this kind of state of mind of distraction is one mode we can be in. And we probably all, you know, in that meditation. Did anyone not experience some time of distraction where the mind went off somewhere else? Please, please. Not me. Certainly mine went off. And I had the added benefit of having to think of, oh, what do I got? You know, what am I going to say? You know, that kind of thing. Keeps you kind of a little disciplined, you know, to actually have a responsibility in this, rather than, you know, if somebody else is doing it, who's to know if you're going to have a little nap, you know, and sometimes we do. But naturally we will. It will happen. And sometimes, you know, and it's not in the least a problem if we can just, you know, the training is just, and the practice is just to keep coming back. So that's the first one mode. Then another mode is when I term contraction. So there's distraction and then contraction. Contraction where it is where we're more kind of we're stuck on something. We're in conflict with something. You know, oh, I'm feeling tired. Oh, I shouldn't be like this. And the mind gets contracted. Oh, why am I so sleepy? I should have had more of a nap, you know, more of a sleep last night, or whatever the story. You know, we can get tight. Or we're feeling restless, or we're bored, or we're wanting something. Oh, I wish I had this right now. And again, either way, whether it's the kind of the more wanting or the more pushing away, it's a difficult and it's a painful place to be. It's a place of contraction. So that's another quality of heart and mind that we can get into. Obviously, in meditation, but also in our daily lives, where we can get stuck in that way. And again, the Buddhist teachings say, you know, there's nothing inherently problematical in that quality of mind. You know, the problem is when we're identified with it, or when we think that it shouldn't be happening, or it should be different than this. If we can bring awareness to the quality, then just in that bringing awareness to it, it loses its problematical quality. You know, it becomes more an object of awareness, and it can have some space around it. And we can see that there's choice available, you know, that we can actually choose to, we could be stuck in it, but we can actually choose to see it coming and going, that we don't have to be stuck in it. So that whatever is arising, you know, and is arising as seemingly in a problematical way, awareness can allow that state to dissolve. You know, it doesn't necessarily happen immediately. We might bring awareness. There might be a strong holding. We might, no, this, you know, this person, they really did do this really bad thing to me. And we might bring awareness to it, but there's still, the mind is coming back to that place, you know. So we might need to work with it quite a lot. We might need to keep opening and then finding it, closing it. We're closing up again. Then we open again for a while. That's really just what the practice is. So there's nothing inherently a problem in those states if we can just bring awareness to them. It's the awareness, in this kind of kind, compassionate awareness, can allow the clinging to fall away. And that's essentially what we're doing in this practice. We're just seeing that the impermanence, that there isn't anything solid here. It's just changing, you know, changing flow of experience, changing phenomena. It's not really me, even though it's easy to identify with it. You know, I'm feeling this about them and they did this to me. So we get to create this strong sense of self. But if we can bring awareness just to this, oh, the energy of the anger or the energy of the fear, then it can, you know, the sense of self falls away. It's kind of not so much a me thing. It's just like, oh, this comes up and I can see it and then it can go again. Again, not to say this is easy, because when we're caught up, you know, there's a lot of energy pulling us in. It's like we can at times be on that wild horse, which is kind of galloping off where it wants to go. And to actually slow that down and begin to guide it where we want it to go, where it's more helpful to go. It may take some effort, take some work, take some awareness. So the contracted mind, not in itself a problem, we can see that, the only real problem with it, or the seeming problem with it, or the problem with it is the clinging, is the holding on. And with awareness, that clinging can fall away, that we can see that nothing really can be clung to, as the Buddha said, and that we suffer when we do cling. So, to let go of the reins, or let go of that clinging. So those are two qualities. The third quality is where we're actually present with our experience, where we're actually here. We're experiencing, what is arising. We're in the present. We're here. We're experiencing what's arising in the body, bringing awareness to it in the body, in the heart, and the mind. And this is the quality that the Buddha speaks about as being the natural quality of the mind, of being, the mind, when it's not caught up in distraction or contraction, naturally rests in this open, spacious, luminous quality, this quality of mind. But the only problem is we lose touch with that. And you could say that even that isn't a problem, it's just something to be seen. It's like, as we, the image is often used of just the sun being obscured by clouds. It's not as though that the sun isn't there. It's not as though this quality of, this luminous quality of mind isn't there. But it's just that we're not seeing it because the mind is identified with the wanting, or with the aversion, or with the distraction. We're somewhere else. So this quality of being, of presence, just being present. And in the meditation, what I was trying to point to was just five practices, really. And I'm kind of, it's helpful for me these days just to see, just to name these things that we're doing in meditation. And we can do in our daily lives. The first is relaxing. Just allowing ourselves to be here in a calm, at ease way. Because if we're not, then we're somewhere else. Then we're in a place of contraction, and it's going to be hard to open to our experience if that's the quality, the dominant or predominant quality. So just to invite that sense of just kind of letting ourselves relax. And when we do that, we're just inviting ourselves into this quality of being present, of being here. So relaxing is a very, very helpful starting point, really, a kind of a place, kind of resting point of platform for meditation, but also for our daily lives, or any time in meditation, not just at the beginning of a meditation, but any time just to relax, just relax out of any sense of, just when we notice we're contracted, just to, come back again. So this quality of relaxing is an invitation to be present. The second invitation is just to open to our experience as it is. We have a lot of different ways of saying this, from the poetry of Rumi, of welcoming the guests, that image of whoever's coming in, difficult memories come in, welcome those guests. Difficult bodily sensations come in, welcome those guests. Feeling of peace or joy comes in, welcome those guests. So we're not differentiating between the experiences, because once we do that, then we suffer, because we want these to stay and we want those to go. And when we're in that kind of relationship with our experience and with life, then we're in conflict with the way things are actually unfolding, because nothing can be held on to. We can never really hold on to the good things in a permanent kind of way. And we can never get rid of the bad things in a permanent way. We may be able to get them out of the way for a while, but the quote, things we tend to put a label of bad on, will come as part of this this being human, you know, we'll experience loss, we'll experience sickness, we'll experience aging, ultimately we'll experience death. And all of these will come. So to try and fight against them, try and kind of permanently keep them away or keep unpleasant experiences away is a strategy for suffering. So the invitation is just to open, you know. So we use a lot of the language of just allowing this moment to be as it is. Unconditional friendliness. Bringing kindness to our experience. So all of this is, again, to kind of invite the heart and the mind to into a quality of presence, into a quality of an attitude of equanimity, of acceptance, of this is. Okay, this moment, as Ajahn Sumedho, a great teacher, elder in our tradition, says, you know, it's like this. It's like this. Whatever it is, it's like this. Oh, this is like, oh, it's like this. Oh, so it's like this, like this. And then we're not making anything special about the experience. It's like, oh, this is how it is. Sometimes it might appear to be really difficult, really painful, really big. It's like this. This is how it is, this moment. So that opening, welcoming the guests. And then the third kind of focus, the third kind of way, practice, if you like, is just focusing the mind. Because if we don't focus the mind, then it's very easy just for, you know, unless we're in a pretty calm and peaceful place. If we're not, if there's anything coming up, very easily we get pulled off, we get pulled into, you know, wherever the energy is in us, you know, maybe something has happened earlier today that hasn't been resolved, and can we keep going back to that? We keep getting pulled back into that. How could that person say that to me? How could my colleague have done that? You know, so we're going back and trying to solve it and resolve it. Or very easily we just go into, you know, the mind is wandering, you know, we're thinking about the words of a song or a movie we've seen or that we're going to see or the, you know, a conversation that we might have with somebody. Easily we just go off. So it's really helpful to do the focusing, to bring our awareness to the breath, to the body, to sounds. So again, that helps. It helps bring us into the present, helps us rest in the present, and allows us to be in this experiencing mode. We're actually here, aware of the breath, aware of the coolness on my skin, aware of the feeling in my torso, aware of the thought coming up. So this is moment-to-moment focusing our attention in that way, using an object or an anchor to do that. Then the fourth practice is just to come back. When we do go off, to come back. So I said relaxing, opening, focusing our attention. When we do inevitably or almost inevitably go off, we just come back again. We return, we begin again. So, you know, even if we have to do that 100 times, just coming back, beginning again, focusing the mind. And then the fifth thing is one that we sometimes don't pay enough attention to, and that's the cultivation of the wholesome qualities of heart and mind. You know, towards the end of the meditation, I spoke about some of the qualities of these awakening factors that the Buddha spoke about, these seven qualities. And there are other positive qualities of generosity and gratitude and compassion and loving kindness. So many, many wholesome qualities. But it's really important that we cultivate them. We spoke last week about how our brains default to the negative, or gravitate towards the negative, to be on the lookout, to be vigilant for what's going to go wrong, what's going to threaten us and all of that. And so we tend to give much more attention to the negative, to taking care of the negative, than to cultivating the positive. And so it's very easy to kind of gloss over good feelings, positive feelings, feelings of openness, feelings of spaciousness. Some of us over time may have developed a brain that doesn't really have time for that at all, because we're so much in the mode, we're in the anxious mode, or we're in the worrying mode, or we're in negative mode, that we don't have time even, or we don't give attention to the positive qualities. So it's really important, wherever we are in that kind of in the spectrum of, you know, more worrying or anxious, or more open or spacious or whatever, wherever we are, it's really important to cultivate these qualities. And Rick Hansen's chapter, I think it's chapter 4, of taking in the good, is a really, really valuable one. That we really need to train ourselves, train our bodies, train the felt sense in the body and the heart and the mind to feel and enjoy those states, you know, when they're arising, and to really program them into our brains. Because unless we take them in for some period of time, we tend to, you know, it's not enough for our consciousness really to take them in and to remember them, and for those to be kind of incorporated into our consciousness. So these five kind of practices of relaxing, of opening, of focusing, coming back, and of cultivating the positive are ways really of being in that mode of being present, this quality of cultivating present moment awareness. So when we're doing that, we're doing basically what the Buddha encouraged and invited us to do, which is in order to find freedom, which is to abandon what's unskillful, kind of let go of the distraction and the contraction just by seeing it, just by opening to it and letting it come and go, and actually actively cultivating the wholesome qualities of heart and mind. And those really are the two central practices. You know, the Buddha broke each of them down into a subset of two. You know, it wasn't just what we do with them when they arise, but we can also, with the unwholesome, with the difficult, with the afflictive states, as well as working with them when they have arisen, we can also prevent them from arising. We can, by inclining our minds towards the positive, inclining our minds towards mindfulness, then the unwholesome qualities don't arise, or are less likely to arise, you know, if we're really present for our experience. So we prevent the arising of the unwholesome states, and we open to them and bring mindfulness to them when they have arisen. So that's what we do with the unwholesome ones. And with the wholesome ones, once they have arisen, cultivating them, we can actually bring them into existence. We can actually invite them to arise. So there are different things we can do to help joy to arise, or calm to arise, or equanimity to arise. And that's really, those are more a subject of another teachings, another course. But these qualities, and we'll talk some about them in the next couple of weeks, but we can cultivate them, we can bring them into existence, and then we can maintain them, we can expand them, these wholesome qualities. So all of that leading into what we'll talk about this evening, of coming back to this, you know, specifically to the science and what the understanding of the brain and where it goes when we're not really paying attention. So, you know, what they've done is studies have shown that when our mind is at rest, it actually becomes more active and produces a lot of mental chatter and distraction. So it would be nice, wouldn't it, if we could just say, sit down and really relax, you know, be relaxed. Let go of all worries and concerns and just relax and be present. Now, the truth is that when we do that, if we do that, unless we were doing it with committed meditators, because committed meditators can have another strategy, which is not to just relax, but to actually pay attention. But if you don't invite people, you know, to pay attention, if you're not cultivating, if you're not actually training the mind to be present, where the mind actually goes is into distraction, into chatter, into a lot of conversation. And it seems, and I mentioned this last week, it seems that what we're doing is when we're just in this kind of not focused but relaxed mode, we're actually looking out for all of the things that we need to take care of, all of the business that we need to take care of, all of the things that could go wrong. So it seems like what we're doing is we're scanning the past to learn from what's happened before in order to be prepared for what might happen in the future. So we're kind of in this constant scanning mode. And this mode is, in fact, an unhappy mode. It's a mode that's more associated with negative qualities, negative feelings, negative affect, than positive. And this what they call this default state, they also call it a kind of a narrative mode, because we're doing a lot of chatting when we're in this mode. We're doing a lot of commentary when we're in this mode. Seems to be universal. Seems to be, you know, whoever you bring, you know, together and ask to just sit and bring, you know, relax, the mind will go into these, you know, this default state. If we don't pay attention and if we don't train the mind will tend to go into this default state of distraction, of dissatisfaction, of chatter, narrative mode. So what is it that's happening in this mode? They've studied, you know, the neuroscientists have studied what is actually going on in these, you know, when we're in this default mode. And there's four things that we're doing. The first is we're commenting on our experience in the present moment. And this is normally, this is more associated with the emphasis tends to be on criticism, on what's wrong, on how things should be. So it's kind of like a commentary, like, okay, what's happening right now? Oh, it's too cold. Oh, I should change this. Oh, now it's got a bit too hot. So it's almost like we've got a thermostat of commentary going, we've gone a bit over this way. And like a thermostat that's kind of too sensitive, it can, you know, it can kind of set alarms off. We've got to solve things. Oh, now we've got to turn it off. Oh, now we've got to turn it on. In this kind of a mode, we're doing this this commentary on our experience, and it's not a happy place to be, because we're kind of in this hypervigilant kind of place when we're in this default state. The second thing we're doing is we're engaged in time travel. We're remembering things that have happened. We're imagining future scenarios. We're projecting into the future from the past. So we're doing this, you know, I mentioned this kind of scanning of the past and the future, kind of sorting things out in this way, projecting into the future. And again, when we're doing this, we're actually missing out on the present moment. We're not present. And we're in this kind of more agitated, more negative frame of mind. And we're missing out. We're not here for connection with our own feelings at that time, our own experience, our own bodies, or with anybody else, because we're caught up in this commentary mode and this kind of distracted mode. The third thing we're doing in this default state is we're involved in self-referential processing, is what they call it. It's interpreting what's going on in terms of ourselves. I'm the person who does this. I'm the person who likes this. And in doing this, we're creating a solid sense of self. We're kind of creating a self. This is who I am, because I like this and I don't like this. I like this person, I don't like that person. We're interpreting what's going on in terms of who we are. Oh, this is happening to me. Oh, I don't like this. You know, this. I'm a person who doesn't like this. Or doesn't. You know. So in this way, we're creating a solid sense of self. That's the third thing. And the fourth thing we're doing is we're engaged in what they call social cognition. We're thinking about other people, and we're thinking about ourselves in relation to other people. So again, we're kind of creating a solid sense of self. And again, as in the third mode thing we're doing, It's not a pleasant state to be in. It's connected more with stress and suffering and negativity than with positive qualities of heart and mind. And so the Buddhist teachings teach that these default tendencies, although that's not the term, a term that's used in Buddhism, but these tendencies create stress and suffering. So what we're doing is, you know, I think in the Buddhist teachings would say we're creating a solid sense of self. We're creating a sense of permanence around experience. You know, we're not seeing the impermanence of things. We're trying to hold on to certain experiences. We're trying to grasp on to things that we like or move towards things that we like, create situations that are going to be, you know, what we like. And in doing that, then we're creating suffering. It's interesting that research has shown that those who spend most time stuck in these default states include people who are depressed, anxious, suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. And it tends to be harder for people who have these conditions to get out of these states. They tend to be more identified with these states. So these, you know, even for those who don't have a particular, you know, condition, psychological condition, but just, you know, just anybody going through their lives will tend to experience, be caught up in these modes, this kind of more distracted default mode, and experience some stress and suffering in doing so. So this is, you know, you could say in a way it's a, you could see it as a kind of a problematical thing that we get caught up in this mode. But the good thing is that it's not the only way that we can be with our experience. That there's an alternative mode that we can, it's like a channel that we can change to, that we can tap into. And all we need to do is just to come back to the present moment. Come back to our experience as it is, and that there is this alternative mode which they call the experiencing mode. It's a mode where we're directly experiencing the present moment. We're aware of the sounds and the sensations and the thoughts arising or the emotions arising, the mind states coming up. And when we're in this alternative mode, this experiencing mode, there's an increased activation of the brain in the parts of the brain connected with the present moment, including awareness of sense experiences and awareness of emotions, and that it's a more positive state of mind to be in. It's more associated with positive wholesome qualities or good feelings rather than more negative feelings. When the experiencing network or mode is active, several different parts of the brain, different brain regions become more active. And this includes the insula, which is a region that relates to perceiving bodily sensations. Another region is the anterior cingulate cortex. This is a region that's important for switching our attention, kind of shifting our attention. So when you're in this experiencing mode, you're experiencing information coming into your senses in real time. And when you're in this mode, it reduces activity in the narrative, you know, in the default mode. So obviously, if you're kind of in that experiencing mode, you're not in the default mode. You're not caught up in, you know, the story and the distraction and all of that. And what they found in, you know, in testing and studying the default mode, is that people who regularly practiced meditation were able to distinguish between the default mode and the experiencing mode much more easily. They could say, oh, I'm in this. And if you've meditated for some time, you can probably have had the experience of saying, oh, lost in thought. Oh, caught up in a difficult emotion. You know, just to be able to see that, rather than if you didn't have some training in meditation, it's much more of a tendency of just to be kind of, you're in the story, and the story is, you know, what's carrying you along. Or you're in the difficult emotion, and the difficult emotion is sweeping you along. But if you've had some experience of bringing awareness to whatever it is that's coming up, you're more in a position to say, oh, that's what this is. Okay, I can come back to my body. Oh, I can come back to the breath. And just that awareness is, you know, as we know, I think is very freeing. It's like, oh, okay, that's where I was. Okay, not a big deal in itself if I can be aware of it. Also, meditators could, you know, more or less saying that, they could switch easily between these states. You know, obviously more helpful to switch out of the default mode into the experiencing mode, rather than, oh, I'm really present right now, I think I'm going to space out, you know, which would probably not be what we'd choose to do most of the time, although sometimes we might choose to do that. What they found is that it's possible to train this experiencing mode in the experiencing part of the brain with just 8 weeks of meditation. And meditation makes it easier to be in the experiential state and to make it the default. And it actually changes the brain. The meditation does, making it thicker and creating more neurons. So I spoke in earlier weeks about the study of people who did the 8-week mindfulness-based stress reduction training and how their brain thickened, cortex thickened in areas connected with awareness and with introspection and with compassion. And thinned in areas connected with stress and with anxiety. So just in 8 weeks of training. When we practice meditation, we spend less time in the default mode and recover more quickly when we go into it. So it's just that, again, that kind of being able to see, oh, I'm here right now, I can come back again. So a couple of other things. Meditation seems to lead to three types of core changes. We recover more quickly from the default mode, and we catch ourselves more quickly. So we recover, we catch ourselves more quickly. Meditators seem to be less in the default mode in everyday life and more in the experiential mode. So, you know, just in going through daily life, you can, you know, they've done studies where they, you know, they phone people up or they send them a message on their iPhone or iPad or Android or whatever and say, where are you now? You know, and are you having a good time? and when people are somewhere else, you know, lost in thought, they tend not to be having a good time. And when they're more present, they tend to be more, you know, tend to be more in a positive frame of mind. So, And meditation practice seems to strengthen areas of the brain that create the experiential state. So all this is to say meditation strengthens the experiencing system, strengthens the ability to be present with our experience, to spend less of our time in distraction, in, you know, in chatter, in time travel, in being somewhere else. And so in this way, you know, again, we see this convergence between the Buddhist teachings, which is saying, You know, when we are caught up in distraction and contraction, in greed, hatred, and delusion, as kind of the terms that are mainly used in Buddhism, then we suffer. And we have the opportunity to see that and to find freedom from suffering by bringing awareness to our experience, seeing that ultimately that it's empty, that we don't have to be caught up in it, that we can let go, see its impermanence, and we can find freedom, freedom from suffering through these practices, practices of mindfulness and compassion, and just awareness of our experience. And so the Buddhist teachings say that these are tendencies of the mind. When we're not seeing things clearly, we do get caught up. We get caught up in clinging, we get caught up in aversion, we get caught up in delusion or distraction. But there is a way out of these stressful, suffering states. And mindfulness in body, mindfulness of feelings, mindfulness of mind states, mindfulness of our experience generally, is a way out of the suffering, is a way to find freedom from suffering. What the science is pointing to is that these tendencies of mind are also say these are associated with suffering, with stress. I mean, stress would be the more, or negativity, these would be the more the words that are used. And that there is an alternative. The alternative is to be aware of our experience, to practice, you know, that in practicing being aware of our experience, in being in the experiential mode, then we're less caught up in negativity and stress and anxiety and these qualities. And so we actually have that choice. The scientific studies point to this a very similar understanding, that we can find a way out of this default mode by coming into our direct present moment experience. So that does seem to be an important kind of point of convergence or mutual understanding between the Buddhist teachings and the scientific studies. So I'm going to see if I can't remember if I spoke about this last week, about the decision-making process. This was another really interesting study, and even if I did, it's probably worth saying again. This was a study that showed that meditators made better decisions because they were able to not pay attention to these messages in the brain saying that something was unfair. You know, they could kind of sidetrack that and were able to make choices that were more, one would say, were more profitable, so more beneficial in some way. Here's what they did. They did these studies. I'll just read how the description of this, and it's kind of a good beginning. If a friend or relative won $100 and then offered you a few dollars, would you accept this windfall? They offered you $5. Hey, here's $5. I've just won $100. The logical answer would seem to be sure. Why not? But human decision making does not always appear rational. According to research conducted over the last 3 decades, only about 1/4 of us would say, sure, thanks. The rest would say, but that's not fair. You've got lots, why are you only giving me a little? In fact, people will even turn down any reward rather than accept an unfair share. Here's the punchline. Unless they are Buddhist meditators. In which case, fair or not, more than half will take what is offered. So the difference is only a quarter of just people in the street would accept, you know, a lesser amount of money. Whereas twice that number, which seems to be statistically significant, twice that number of Buddhist meditators when they say Buddhist meditators, I assume they're not saying people that they have to be Buddhist, but just they're doing Buddhist meditation, they're doing mindfulness meditation, let's say, are more likely to accept the offer than others. The research shows that Buddhist meditators use different areas of the brain than other people when confronted with unfair choices, enabling them to make decisions rationally rather than emotionally. The meditators had trained their brains to function differently and make better choices in certain situations. So I'll talk about this a little bit more. One of the researchers said, the research highlights the clinically and socially important possibility that sustained training in mindfulness meditation may impact distinct domains of human decision-making. So the research, it showed that the meditators could uncouple emotional reaction from their actual behavior. So here's how they did the study. They used computational and neuroimaging techniques to study the brains of the meditators and of a control group. So there were 26 meditators and 40 control subjects. And they looked at their brain processes using functional MRI while the subjects played what was called the ultimatum game, in which the first player proposes how to divide a sum of money and the second can accept or reject the proposal. So, you know, I'd have $20, let's say, and you're my partner, and I say to you, well, how about I give you $10? Now, presumably, almost anybody would say, hey, good deal, $10, you got 10, I got 10, great. Then I might say, well, okay, I'm going to give you $5. You accept $5? Then some people begin to say, oh, that doesn't seem very fair. Doesn't seem fair at all. And then, you know, then you begin to find a difference between the control group and the meditators. You get down to $2 or $1, and a lot of people are saying, this is outrageous. I'm no way I'm going to accept this. And more likely, the Buddhist meditators are going to say, hey, it's $1, $2, yeah, I'll take it, you know. So what they found, and they looked at the areas of the brain involved, it said, the neuroimaging results showed that Buddhist meditators engaged different parts of the brain than expected. The researchers explained, the anterior insula has previously been linked to the emotion of disgust and plays a key role in marking social norm violations, rejection, betrayal, and mistrust. So this is clearly something that's deeply rooted in our, you know, in our evolution, that if somebody, you know, if somebody did something really terrible, they would be ostracized, presumably, and they'd feel really bad about it, or they feel bad about somebody else doing this. That's a terrible thing to do. So this part of the brain, the insula, anterior insula, is activated in these. Doing something that's really disgusting, that's really outrageous, that's really terrible, that's a betrayal. You know, these very, very strong emotions, mind states. In previous studies of this ultimatum game, anterior insula activity was higher for unfair offers. So the more unfair the offer was, the more the perception was of this, the offer being unfair, the more this area of the brain would get lit up. And the strength of its activity predicted the likelihood of an offer being rejected. So if this part of the brain is lighting up, you know, it's really getting fired up, then the scientists could look at that and say there's a good chance this person is going to reject this offer because they're really activated by this. You offered me $1 out of $20? This is outrageous. However, in meditators, the anterior insula showed no significant activation for unfair offers. So they were offered $1 or $2, and there was very little activation of that area of the brain. So it seems like it wasn't that the area was activated, but they were somehow able to ignore it. It seemed like they were actually bypassing that area of the brain in this study, with these kind of offers. And there was no significant relationship between anterior insular activity and offer rejection. So it wasn't as though you could say, well, okay, they're being activated and they're going to, you know, reject the offer, or they're not being activated and they're not going to reject the offer. They didn't find any real correlation in the meditators between the activation in the insula and whether or not they would accept the offer. So it seems like there was a kind of a bypassing of this area of the brain. And what they say here is, hence meditators were able to uncouple the negative emotional response to an unfair offer, presumably by attending to internal bodily states, interoception, reflected by anterior in the posterior insula. So another area of the brain connected more with bodily states. So it's as though the meditators, or maybe they were, meditators were able to kind of check in with their bodies, this area of the brain associated with disgust and betrayal wasn't activated. And so they were more in a position to say, yeah, sure, dollar, I'll accept a dollar, you know. They might still, presumably on a rational level, be an understanding that this, you know, wasn't particularly fair, but they weren't emotionally activated. There wasn't that activation around it that there was in the others, or to a much, much lesser extent. And this, the researchers concluded, when assessing unfair offers, meditators seem to activate an almost entirely different network of brain areas than do normal controls. Controls draw upon areas involved in theory of mind, prospection, episodic memory, and fictive error. Take that, you know, any way you want. I don't complex terms. In contrast, meditators instead draw upon areas involved in internal awareness of internal bodily states and attention to the present moment. This study suggests that the trick may lie not in rational calculation, but in steering away from what-if scenarios and concentrating on the interoceptive qualities, the internal bodily states that accompany any reward, no matter how small, so that they could feel the good feeling associated with getting something rather than being caught up in that area where the negative was really the dominant thing. So that the meditation seemed to allow a going into a different part of the brain and activating a different part of the brain, awareness of overall bodily states, rather than being in this particular state. So it sounds like, you know, it sounds a lot like, not necessarily the same brain regions, but the studies of the default, you know, the default mode and the experiencing mode were alternative modes of being, really, of perceiving. So I found this to be a very interesting study, that it suggests that that meditators might be the best people to be, Wall Street investors. You know, I'm not suggesting anyone that we do that, but that you can, that if you can kind of, if you can activate, you know, activate different parts of the brain in relation to, you know, not being so caught up in the emotions of a situation or the fairness of a situation.
Congressmen should be meditators.
They should be meditators. There is one.
Yes, right.
Congressman Ryan. So anyway, we'll stop here for this evening. Next week, I'd like to talk more about the studies and, you know, how the brain is impacted by meditation and how it changes. And have a great week.